Okay, yeah, no worries. Often happens the mic dropping. So I have a Mac and a PC running at the moment. I'm logged in twice. I like to fill the room with myself just in case that happens. So good evening. This week we're going to be looking at number four of our yamas. Hi, Kathy. Hi. which is called Brahmacharya. Brahmacharya, it's a juicy one. It's one of the most contentious of all the yamas, and maybe even the yamas and niyamas together, and it's the one that gets a lot of disagreement. So we're going to look at that one tonight. But before we do, we are going to start with the consecration, as usual. So that's really just taking a moment to recognize this moment as sacred and just sort of relaxing and grounding, whatever that means to you. So just maybe relaxing the feet into the ground or the bottom of the spine into the chair. Relaxing the shoulders and the face, but keeping the crown lifted up to the ceiling or the sky. And then becoming aware of the breath moving in and out of the nostrils as we slowly begin to quieten in the mind. And then just following this breath up and over the skull, down, dropping down into the chest and expanding outwards, our heart center, our Anahata chakra. Having a sense of us connecting to everyone. And then from here, we're just going to make an offering, our consecration. So offering up our time together this evening, or indeed our whole day, to the benefit of all beings, to the service of not only ourselves but of others. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be at peace. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace. We'll take a deep inhale and exhale it out. Okay, so Brahmacharya, bit of a tricky one. I know that I have found it hard to understand the essence of Brahmacharya. And as I mentioned, it's pretty contentious and people feel quite passionately about it. I know I wrote an article about Brahmacharya a little over a year ago, and I remember I hadn't really quite understood it, but I sort of roughly had an idea. I can absolutely type that into the board. Hello. You missed the punchline there. I was just saying, I don't know where we dropped off, but I was just saying that I wrote this article and I got many responses to people disagreeing with the meaning. And there are many, many, many meanings for this. But the main one is celibacy. So that's why it's a bit of a contentious one, because it's celibacy, and obviously that triggers a lot of people, because people go, oh, no, now you've lost me. No, forget yoga, I'm not doing it if I have to be celibate. That's too hard for me, thank you very much, goodbye. And then some people will say, no, actually, it's not really celibacy, and then, you know, make excuses. So we're going to really try and explore what Brahmacharya is this evening. So one of the translations is literally, if you take Brahma, God, and then Charya is sort of to stand firm in, or to walk with, or stay in. And in this sense, Brahma actually is the creative energy, the creative source. in this case, it's not sort of, some people like to say it's walking with God or staying with God, but it's much more about the sort of creative energy of that source. So it's not sort of, you know, God as a person or being. It's like this energy that exists that is really like the most creative energy there is. And so this is where sort of, you know, the Yamas are very sort of intellectually based, I suppose. They're sort of easily explained. We've talked about, you know, ahimsa and non-violence and truthfulness, and last week it was non-stealing. And then we get to Brahmacharya and people get a bit sort of, whoa, what are we talking about now? Now we're talking about energy, what? And really, this is what Brahmacharya is dealing with. It's conserving this creative energy. So this is sort of Brahma being the creative energy that's within us, and Charya in sort of staying with it. So when we talk about celibacy, what we're really saying is almost sort of continence of this creative energy that's within us. And it's almost, it's very beautiful to think about the fact that, you know, we were created, we come from this creative energy, and we hold that inside us. And obviously, how we hold that inside us is in our sexual energy. So first and foremost, Brahmacharya deals with our sexual energy and how to conserve it and why we should conserve it. And it's kind of interesting because when you think about it, you know, a lot of religions have the same feeling that, you know, you shouldn't just go around having sex willy-nilly, that there should be some, excuse me, dropping the mic, sort of conservation, being more thoughtful about using sex. And why is that? So yoga sort of talks about this sexual energy with two premises. So the first is create. And if you take it on a physical level, that's obviously through having sex and creating a child, which is like the highest peak of creativity you can possibly have as a human being on a physical plane. And this energy, the yogis say, is called ojas. And I'm going to type that into the room too. It's O-J-A-S. Ojas. So on an energy level, yogis, and bear with me, believe that there is a life force called prana. Pranayama, for example, is breath work that sort of increases prana. And prana is available to us in the air and in food and in the sunlight. It's this whole life force. And it keeps us going. It keeps us vital. We're bringing this prana. Ojas is like a type of prana, and it's a liquid prana. And it's deep within us. Some say it's held sort of near the sacrum at the bottom of the spine. Some people say it's in our organs, but it's basically carried for men in the sperm and for women in also sort of liquid ejaculation in the point of sex, but also in menstrual fluid. And we won't be talking about sex all night, just bear with me. If you just had to, you know, you're not feeling it right now, there are other things we're going to talk about. But predominantly Brahmacharya is about this sexual energy, this ojas. So I say, so women hold it in their menstrual fluids and sometimes through liquids that released in the act of sex, and men have it in their sperm. So the sexual energy that we have that's stored in this liquid is seen as incredibly potent because, of course, it connects us to our creator. And so it's considered by the yogis as being very, very, very special and therefore something not to be wasted. And in fact, well, the reason we wouldn't waste it is because this sexual energy of creation can actually be moved and expressed in a way that isn't sexual, but actually increases our sort of chances of self-realization. So instead of expending this energy, the yogis say better to store it and use it through different methods that we'll talk about later to sublime it and to purify our other chakras and to move the energy upwards and to keep all of that beautiful creative energy focused around God. and our spiritual path. So, for example, it's like, I guess another way of looking at it is like you've got a battery, and you can use the energy from the battery or the fuel in your tank, however you like to look at it, an internal application rather than out. Yes, and we're going to come to that, how we don't release the energy outwards, but we move it inwards. So, So what we're saying is we can move this energy out or up in a different way, or it's certainly we can use the energy to be more aligned to pure creative energy, so Brahman. So instead of wasting it on, you know, overdoing sex and having sex, you know, I say with many people or many times a day, whatever it is, we can actually take this creative energy, which wants to move and be creative, and do things like serve others, or meditate and move the energy upwards, as I mentioned, and clear our chakra and reach sort of enlightened levels or sort of altered states of consciousness where we experience bliss. So this is why you would want to sort of, this is why the yogis might think about celibacy, because it's much, much easier to say to people, oh, you know, just don't have sex. Just don't have sex at all, and work out another way to sort of take this powerful, powerful, most potent energy that we have, and move it, and you know, do something for God with it instead. Now, however, the tantrics do not say that at all, and we're going to come to that in a minute. So obviously celibacy is a very easy thing to say. The other premise that the yogis make about Ojas is kind of a downer, in that we are born with a finite amount. So it's said that we're born with something like 3.5 drops of Ojas. I don't know what that means or how big a drop is. But we're born with it. We have enough fuel in the tank. And it's up to us how fast we use it and what we use it on. And as Ojas gets depleted, and it gets depleted in ways other than through sex, and we'll talk about that bit in the second half. As it gets depleted, then we begin to age quicker. So naturally, as our life goes on, we are just naturally using Ojas. So Ojas can be, it's not in its purest form, but, you know, on, you know, physical activity or mental activity, and these are the bits we're going to talk about in the second part. So, and then, you know, as life goes on, we're gradually using up more and more and more and more and more, and aging, and then we eventually die. And some of the yogis, and my Swami was talking about this in an audio I was listening to the other day, that, you know, thousands of years ago, people lived to be 800 years old. And we kind of see this in some of these ancient spiritual texts that they talk about, oh, and so the Lama or this guru was, you know, 1,000 years old. And that was because it said that they understood the power of their Ojas. And so they used that 3.5 drops really, really slowly. And so they were able to live much longer. So it's kind of interesting. So we have this apparent 3.5 drops. So that's another reason you really want to think about conserving this. They all sort of have very sort of emotional attachments to it and judgments around it and experiences and good and bad that we've had. So we have a lot of stories around sexual energy. So if you want to call it creative energy, call it that. Let me see here. Yeah, so the yogis say, you know, it's a really, really precious energy. And so you have to think about it a lot. It's not like, you know, these days, you know, people with sexual energy are seen as, you know, a bit weird. But as my Swami says, if you're the hornier you are, the greater your chances of reaching self-realization, because you've obviously got this energy in you that you can just move up. So what I was sort of talking about earlier, and forgive me, I've got crazy cold, so my head is a bit of a fog, is that it's far easier to say just be celibate, which is why a lot of religions and those who are sort of really devout in a yogic path will just say, you know, that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to be celibate. I don't have to think about anything else. I'm just going to stop having sex. It's the easiest thing to do. It's not, but it's the simplest thing to do, perhaps, rather than start to think about is it really, is Brahmacharya asking us to, yeah, this all or nothing, is Brahmacharya really asking us to do that? And, you know, think if you, when you think about people who do give up sex for God, it's an incredibly admirable thing to do. It's, I mean, I don't know about you, but I can't imagine I would be able to do it. I mean, maybe, I don't know. But certainly people who choose to do so at the age of 20, it really is, you know, it's a beautiful thing to love God so much that you're willing to sort of store and use this amazing creative energy you've been born with, that's been passed on to you from the Creator, as a way to then connect with the Creator. It's beautiful. But the tantrics, however, have a whole different view. So the tantrics use every single thing that they see and come across as a means to become enlightened. So they're really into astrology and astronomy and science and nature, and they use the body. So they consider Brahmacharya as something slightly different. They say it's about conserving that ojas, that energy, but through the process of some practices that are tantric sexual practices. So, you know, we often think about the tantrics and we think, oh, they're all about tantric sex. Tantric sex is like 5% of the whole of tantric yoga. However, it's an important part because ojas, as we've, you know, talked about, is this the most vital, this liquid energy that connects us to a creator inside us. So Shirley's just written in, ojas, meaning in Sanskrit, is vigor. Yeah, vigorousness. It's like this vital liquid energy, ojas. So the tantrics say, well, there is a way not to just expend this ojas outwards. And that's through, there are a couple of things that you can do for this. And they're not easy. They are hard to do and hard to practice. But if you are, you know, really dedicated to having a fruitful sexual life and reaching God, then this would be your practice. And also the tantrics are very romantic, and they believe you can reach enlightenment not alone in a cave, but in union with another. So it's very beautiful. So for men, there's something called the injaculation rather than ejaculation. And that is that there are some practices you can do in pranayama and breath work, focusing on the ajna, the third eye chakra, as the yoga postures and certain things your partner can do and help you with. That mean that you do not ejaculate. You actually move that energy inwards and have an internal ejaculation. So you don't expend your ojas. It actually, the energy releases inside of you, which I know some friends who are tantrics, and this is what they do. It's a great form of birth control as well. But what they tell me is that it's like a very, very, very powerful orgasm, and you don't feel depleted afterwards. Instead, they say that you feel so energized, you feel you could run a marathon. So you're taking this super, super powerful energy that's ready to be released, and you don't have that much of it, and instead just moving it inside. And there is, say, there are practices you can do, tantric practices you can do for that. And then for women, it's a kind of a similar thing on the sex front. You say there are a pranayama and practices with your partner and meditations that you can do and sort of other tricks and wonderful things you can do to learn how to not have just a regular orgasm. And in Tantra, there are like 5 or 6 or 7 types of orgasm. It's kind of crazy. Not having a regular orgasm where your energy is expended outwards. You can sort of feel it down, moving downwards, as you say, moving away. But actually, it moves internally and you have a full body orgasm. So there are lots of practices you can do on your own and with your partner to allow for that. And as I say, it's a similar thing to what happens with the men. You have this, you move that energy sort of to be sort of internally, and it's experienced internally, so you get to store your ojas. And as a result of that, the menstruation for women who can do this becomes very, very light, and probably just 2 or 3 days a month. And again, I have some friends who are very big into practicing, and that's the case for them, and they're all sorts of ages, actually, but that's been their experience. And again, there are sort of yoga postures and pranayama. You don't have to go the way of tantric sex, but there are other things you can do just to keep your menstrual cycle. They must be thrilled, says Kathy. Yeah, absolutely, right? So, and it doesn't affect your fertility at all. It's not bad for you. It's just sort of storing this energy, because as women, often as we get older, have longer and longer periods, and they're heavier and heavier, and we're really just losing, according to the yogis, like a lot of that vital energy, and it leaves us feeling a bit drained, and can contribute to premature aging. So if you know that appeals, then tantric sex is really something to look at. If you are interested in my school for yoga, it's a tantric school, and it's Agama Yoga. That's A-G-A-M-A Yoga, and I believe it's .com. And on that website, if you look at resources and then go to audios, there are just tons and tons of audios from my Swami about tantric sex, and actually the Brahmacharya audio within the Yamas and Niyamas section. It's a 2-hour talk predominantly about Brahmacharya from a tantric perspective. So if you're interested in that, I would go and check out that website and have a look around it. So let me just see what else I've got here. I mean, they're very, in the yogis, it's one of the reasons that the word celibacy gets a bit of a bad rap when you're talking about Brahmacharya, is that it's not helpful to anyone in particular. As I mentioned before, you know, a couple of weeks ago, one of the beautiful things about the Yamas and Niyamas is they're one word. And so they don't have this, you should do this and you should do that. They sort of allow you to unpack them and explore them. And Sanskrit, as I mentioned, has so many different ways a word can be translated, that it sort of allows you to sort of figure it out yourself and practice yourself. But the problem with the word celibacy is you would hear the word celibacy and therefore you would just go and be celibate, and you could end up, you know, with some issues. You could have like major sexual repression. You don't know how to move that energy. You don't know what to do with that energy. It could make you sick. It could make you frustrated and maybe even angry. And maybe, you know, as you're meditating, obviously, if you're committed to yoga and you're maybe working with some of the other limbs of yoga or the other yamas, niyamas, you'd figure it out that it's not just about being celibate. It's about taking or tapping into that beautiful energy within you and moving it upwards. But sometimes I think that Brahmacharya is one of those yamas that really requires a teacher to kind of just sort of guide you through it and explain it. Because it would just be awful to go and just be celibate and then be sat there in your frustrations and then wonder why 20 years, you know, I've been celibate 20 years, why am I not enlightened yet? And then someone taps you on the shoulder and says, oh, you have been moving all that energy up, right? Not just sat there in frustration. You're like, oh, nope, didn't know. So that's why the word celibacy gets a bit of a bad rap. And some people prefer to use the word continence for Brahmacharya. So in addition to some of the sort of more esoteric tantric practices of moving that energy upwards, and some of them are really, really beautiful and can really sort of bring you together by your own, like bring your sort of self whole, but also with another person. So they're really lovely, and it's not about sort of switching partners. It really is about having a loving relationship with the partner. The tantrics get a bit of a bad rap sometimes because us Westerners have had a habit of just taking some of these awesome sexual practice, like practical teachings of how to improve our sex life, but we haven't coupled it with this opening of the heart and sort of the soulful connection to another, and this union of the yin and the yang is reaching one. Because ultimately, you know, the yogis say that the deepest desire of a human is to reach oneness or Brahma or the absolute. And so in everything, in every cell of our being, there is a plus and a minus. It's like attraction and division going on. And so we have this sort of innate within us. We are attracted to someone else. And there is this idea of wanting to come together to reach oneness, to reach this union of bringing these two sides together, of letting go of duality. And so how that manifests physically is just sort of this attraction between two people. But it's also sort of like a metaphor for what we want individually as on our spiritual path, this sort of coming together and becoming the void or oneness. So tantric sex is one thing that can be practiced, but also it's helpful, I think, with this, and I say this can sort of bring up a lot of stuff for people, so it's always good to look at. And in that case, it's just looking at our own sexual energy and sort of tuning into that. So one of the practices of Brahmacharya, if you want to sort of delve into this yama, is just kind of noticing what is the nature of that energy that is within us. Now, where in the body does it arise for us? What is our tendency with that energy when we feel it arise? Do we judge it? Do we think about repressing it? Do we go and open the fridge and stuff ourselves full of food? Do we call up our partner and say, you better get around here right now? Do we rush to be satisfied? And even in the act of having sex, are we rushing? Are we aiming for the goal? Are we not enjoying the person we're with? Are we being present? So there's a lot that can be explored, obviously, just by considering Brahmacharya from a purely sexual point of view. And then we can, you know, it's such a rich, and as I say, it's sort of a triggering topic for a lot of people. But the beauty of the yama, in fact, is just one word. It means that, you know, there's no judgment around it. There's no, you should do this and you shouldn't do that, as we've seen. You can be sort of celibate if you like, but you can also be having crazy wild tantric sex if you like, or you can be doing something in between. But it just sort of allows us to sort of a safe place without judgment to just really look at ourselves. And I sort of think it's a fun thing to do, is to sort of track over the month how, you know, what happens with our libido. When does it go up? When does it go down? What is our reaction to it? And if we're not feeling any, then how do we get sort of back in touch with this ojas, this sexual energy within us, which is potent, and we can move up into our sort of higher chakras, as it were, and or use that energy as sort of the passion for our spiritual journey. So sort of just getting in touch with that part of us that often we tend to sort of put to one side. Or we tend to have it at the very front of our focus and are a bit kind of obsessed with, but not in the right way. So it's so that's the part on sex. And say I would check out agamayoga.com and the resources and audios there if you're interested in that. And you can always email me. I've got some great books I'd recommend. If you are, is it possible, says Kathy, that can be totally redirected away from the sexual expression? Yes, absolutely. So, for example, you could take that energy, that sexual energy, which really, again, if we just think of it as creative, and use it to paint paintings, to, as I say, give us the fuel to serve others. I don't know if you're familiar with Peace Pilgrim, but I remember she talked about how, you know, she was up in her years, and just walked and walked and walked across America on this path of peace. And she says at some point that she never tires, and people far younger than her would walk along with her, and she just felt like she was running on this beautiful energy. And never having known her and not talked to her about that, I can't possibly say if this is OJAS she's running on, but I would, you know, it's possible that that it doesn't have to be expressed, you know, through sex, that you can take that and then have this very vital life. And I was reading last night, Alberto Villoldo is this amazing shaman. He runs the Four Winds Society, I believe, who founded that. And I was reading one of his books, Shaman, Healer, Sage, and he talks about, you know, a similar thing. He was a young man and he was in Peru, and he was being given these sort of really difficult physical tasks by the shaman there as he was training with him. And they were like 70, 75 and outrunning him and outclimbing him. And they were saying, well, just, you know, they were in touch with this energy, this like electrical force. And we all know that feeling, powerful and electrical. And so we can move it up and out. So in addition to sort of, you know, being creative, you know, I don't know, people sort of, I know people joke that when they have an orgasm, they go, oh, well, there goes another novel, which I always found quite funny. But you can use it for learning. And some of the yogis, you know, when they're training young guys, they're not allowed to have sex until they're 21. And it's there because they use all that energy for learning, for spiritual learning and for, you know, yeah, for learning. So lots of things, you can run marathons, be very, you know, achieve physical feats. You could use it to find a cure for cancer. With, like, it's, imagine what this energy is. It comes, it's the same, it's the taste of the creative energy of the universe, and it's within us. So it sort of knows no bounds and can be sort of, yeah, redirected away from that into something. But the point is, it should be redirected, if it's going to be redirected, into something that enhances your relationship with the divine or serves others. So it shouldn't be used for just getting frustrated and then moving up into the mind and having all these angry thoughts and then going out and killing a bunch of people, you know, because you were sexually repressed or you didn't know what to do with that energy. Like, that is not it. Or, you know, some sort of like teenagers will really play up in school. They're just not directing that energy upwards. So in addition to sort of being very, you know, creative or physically expressing or serving others or walking across the country or climbing up mountains with shaman, there are just basic tantric practices that are things like visualizing the energy moving up into the heart, into the heart area. And it's very beautiful and very cleansing. It's said to be this super, super cleansing energy when you start to move it up. And that takes a fair amount of practice to do, but it's entirely possible. And then the other, you know, one of the other reasons I didn't mention this earlier, that the tantrics sort of say you move that energy inwards, is because it prolongs your sort of sexual bliss. So, if, you know, that moment of orgasm might be, I don't know, 20 seconds, if you're lucky, I don't know. But it's not long enough to really delve into and go, wow, what is this bliss? What is this electrical thing that's happening here? And that's my connection to everything. And like the yogi says, all of nature, like nature is... it's like the force, sexual energy is the force in all of nature, it's in all of us, it's in everything in the entire universe. So when you start to have these sort of tantric sex practices, and say you can do that on your own or with a partner, there's, you know, it doesn't matter, that you move that energy up into your heart, then you have like orgasms that last for like, I don't know, how long does Sting say? Like an hour, a couple of hours, might be too much, I don't know. But even if it's 10 minutes, it gives you a better chance of delving into that blissful experience and trying to see what that is. and understand the meaning of bliss and ecstasy, which is in line with, an experience of samadhi, or, you know, a self-realizing experience, something like that, this sort of blissful experience. So that's another thing. So it doesn't have to be, it's kind of a sexual expression, but it's, you can figure it out yourself by moving this energy up into your heart, and that creates like this whole body experience. That's like the main thing. But other than the sex part, OJS, as I mentioned earlier, to a much lesser degree, but is expended in like our mental thoughts, our mental like ramblings. So we all know those, that we have those things that we just, you know, we call it mental masturbation, where we, you know, maybe we're addicted to reading the news. So I don't know why I always use the news as an example. Or where we go off in like a fantasy land and start thinking about, oh, you know, well, maybe my boss will do this, and then I'll do this, and then I'll go this, and my house will look like this, and this is what I'm doing with the lottery money this week if I win it. And it's really just, it's a waste of energy. Say the yogis, you're using OJAS up in those moments. So try and just like bring it in, and then think more about, or control more. So another word for brahmacharya is, or two words, I guess, is self-control. And it's not just our thoughts. It's, you know, it's everything that we do. Do we overdo it at the gym? You know, how many times in a week do we say stuff like, oh, I've really overdone it this week? And whether we're talking about that we drank too much, that we smoked too much, that we ate too much, that we, as I say, like, went crazy at the gym, ran a little too far. And it's in all the ways that we overdo things, where we're not able just to say, this is enough for me. That is also brahmacharya, say the yogis. And again, you know, I mentioned it's a bit contentious. So some people say, oh, it's not about sex at all. It's about everything. But yes and no. That most of it's about the sexual energy, but there's also this energy within us that's used in general, this sort of general prana. So I was thinking about it, you know, I studied economics, and the law of diminishing returns. I always think brahmacharya is a bit like that. This whole idea of, you know, you have one beer and it tastes really good, and then you have your second beer and it tastes even better, and then your third beer doesn't taste quite as good as the second beer, and your fourth beer is there, and then your eighth beer, you actually feel terrible. It was a terrible idea to drink it. And that's kind of where brahmacharya kind of gets you. It wants you to have pleasure. The yogi is definitely not about not having pleasure. You're supposed to enjoy life. But it's about, oh, Hank's in the room. Hi, Hank. It's about sort of finding this moderation. And that's another word that's often used for brahmacharya. People like to talk about moderation. So I was thinking about this, especially this time of year. We've got the holidays coming. And I was thinking about, you know, the times I feel excess, and it sickens me a bit, and you can sort of feel that your energy is dropping due to excess. And the holidays, of course, is a great time to think about it, because we overeat and we overspend. But I remember one year, it was Christmas, and I had it might have been the first year I had like a proper like partner, where I spent Christmas with his family and then Christmas with mine. And I remember we went to his family, and he had a big family, and they were all like crazy for Christmas and crazy for gifts. And so we spent Christmas Eve like opening all these gifts. And then Christmas Day, we went to my parents. My parents are also mad for Christmas and like completely overspend. And I remember trying to open the gifts that my parents had bought us, and just, I started to feel like sick and really tired, because I just felt like every gift I was opening was just like another thing, and it all just felt like so much, so excessive, that it's that kind of thing where it sort of leaves a bad taste in your mouth, and you kind of end up going, oh my god, this is kind of just, it's all too much. And like, I think sort of naturally we have a sense of what is enough, and sort of taking just what we need, or maybe having a little bit more, but then sort of coming back into balance. So it's sort of, you know, the practice of brahmacharya really is about sort of looking at where are all the ways that we are maybe being greedy, or overdoing it, or as I say, with the thoughts, kind of just wasting them by thinking about things that are pointless. And how can we just sort of bring ourselves back into this recognition that we have something very sacred within us, and that all of life is sacred because everything has this beautiful ojas, this creative expression within it. And how can we sort of remain true to that, and just focus on that, really? And one of the other things I think it looks at brahmacharya is sort of this addiction that we have to emotional states. So this is something that comes up in the Bhagavad Gita, and we've talked about before, this idea that we get sort of drawn away with the senses. Pratyahara, which was one of the other limbs of yoga, sort of teaches us to try and break that chain where the senses want to drag us away, and then before we know it, we've lost control and the mind goes off. And it's to try and keep that back in. It's a similar thing to brahmacharya. So that when we notice maybe we want to have another drink, or have another cookie, or another turkey sandwich, we can begin to sort of just break down, hang on, is it because, you know, it's attached to sort of a state of pleasure I've had before? Is it that I'm just trying to distract myself from dealing with, I don't know, some grief I'm feeling right now, or yeah, the sort of more attitude? But is that from something else? Is there something underlying that? So brahmacharya can really start to help us get underneath some of our addictions that often go unnoticed, and begin to notice a lot of distractions. I know last week I was talking about how I'd had a bunch of, you know, I had this moment where I had no distractions, and I suddenly realized all this self-hatred I had inside that I hadn't dealt with. But I wouldn't have noticed because ordinarily I would have had a drink and I would have played with my phone. And so even those sort of things, like playing with your phone and checking your Facebook or checking your email, or whatever, all those tiny things you are, like you do, brahmacharya also looks at that and says, hang on a minute, what are you doing here? You're sort of wasting your time. That's right, on these distractions. And addiction is such a funny thing, and it's so sort of sly. It's really interesting. I remember that I was thinking about times when I've seen other people's addictions with clarity. I've seen my own with a lot of clarity. I was a huge drinker and a huge smoker. So I've been fortunate enough to look at those addictions. But I remember I have this dear friend who is very wise and has been on the spiritual path for a really long time, very generous, really giving, like just an all-round, such love comes out of her. Just such a great woman. And I lived beneath her. And I took my dog to get spayed. My dog needed to get spayed for a second time because they'd screwed up the first time. And sadly, because it was the second time, it didn't go very well. And it was sad. And I woke up in the night and she was crying, wasn't healing. And when I got up in the morning, she was bleeding from her sutures and still crying. And it was about 9 a.m. and it was a Sunday. And so I was really, really upset and thought, well, I'm going to have to rush her to an emergency vet. I didn't have a car. So I called my friend upstairs and I said to her, hey, you know, this awful thing has happened. And she knew Millie well, my dog. And was like, oh, God, you know, it's terrible. And she's bleeding, whatnot. And she said, okay, well, I can't do anything unless I've had my morning coffee. So can you just give me 15 minutes? And I remember thinking, what? Like, wow. Like, I cannot believe I'm hearing this. Like, it was so interesting. Like, her like, absolute addiction to coffee, the most, like, generous, kind, sweet person I knew, meant that she was prepared to say, you know what, your dog can bleed for another 15 minutes because I'm going to need to make my morning coffee. So this kind of made me laugh. And I know that we all do things like that, but she was completely oblivious to it. And only like years later, because I've known her a long time, we were joking about it. She was like, you know, I need to crack this addiction to coffee. And I was like, yeah, tell me about it. And I told, reminded her of this story. And she was like, oh my God, forget it. Yeah, as Kathy says, we have these conditioned habits. So I was thinking about how interesting it is, like, what is underlying that? Or what is it that is not wrong with addiction, but why don't we want to be addicted? So I was thinking about my own addictions, and what I realized was that there's a real shame that comes with not being able to control ourselves. I remember I had so much shame around how much I was drinking and smoking that I then became a secret smoker where I had this whole ritual down. And so I'd go and hide and smoke a cigarette, and then I'd wash my hands, but I'd be wearing a towel around my head while I smoked so no one would be able to tell that my hair smelled of smoke, and I'd wash my face and then I'd brush my teeth and then I'd come back. So I was completely still in shame, however. And then I began to realize, but it's not anyone else who's making me feel shame. It's actually, there is just this feeling of shame that comes with not being able to be in control and doing things that are, you know, a waste of our ojas, of our energy. And actually smoking, they say, is like just kills prana. So that's sort of the other energy that we have, this life force we have. And so I felt like maybe we have this internal setting. And then obviously, you know, by the way, we all know that cycle of, if you've ever been an addict, if you have this shame and then you do more of that thing and then feel more shame, and you do more of that to help you feel better, feel more shame. So you can get into a real spiral, and it's devastating. It's really hard when you have an addiction. But yeah, it sort of made me realize that that we seem to have this, the lengths we go to hide what we're ashamed of, says Kathy. But we have this sort of natural feeling inside, this like natural alarm clock that says, nope, what about, you know, like some self-control? And it's not really a judgment. Shame is obviously a judgment, but it's like a feeling of, even before we feel the shame, of this sense of that, you know, it would be nice to be sort of in control and in balance. It seems like a more of a natural state. One of the things that Deborah Adele, who I just love, suggests when she talks about brahmacharya, and she talks about brahmacharya only as moderation. She talks about just sort of being mindful in everything we do, and just, you know, not eating too much and not doing anything too much, noticing what owns us rather than, you know, what we're controlling. But she talks about that when we really practice brahmacharya, it's about understanding the sacredness in everything, and the sacredness that we hold within us, and not wasting that. So she sort of sees this sort of sexual energy as like just a feeling of sacredness. And she says, you know, one way to practice brahmacharya is to get back in touch with the simple things in life. And she says, and it's often those things like, you know, watching a leaf blowing in a wind, or watching our dog sleep, or our partner, our child sleep, that really bring us this joy. And when we become really in touch with the sacredness, we begin to realize that so little is needed, that we really don't have to want for very much at all. And everything is so sort of beautiful and sort of provided for or not. And we begin to sort of cultivate this sense of awe and wonder when we start to practice brahmacharya, or we practice cultivating our sense of awe and wonder in order to get in touch with brahmacharya. And we can sort of feel that really sort of beautiful, peaceful energy where everything feels very balanced when we do these sort of practices. So, and other practices for brahmacharya, see, we're heading towards 9:30. So other practices we could do are things like pausing and giving thanks often, just sort of reminding us that that something inside is sacred. So that would be one thing we do. And obviously the consecration that we do at the beginning of bringing our time together is another thing that I sort of like to use as a practice, to always come back to this idea of this moment being sacred. And taking time out in the day to sort of just be at peace and sort of sit with the simplicity of sitting without these distractions, without the need to sort of stuff our faces or have a drink. I always think, it wasn't until I came to America, I mean, it's the same in England now, but I remember coming to America and being just amazed at how everywhere people went, they were carrying a drink. And then they get into their car with a drink. I was like, wow, people can't seem to be without a drink anytime. I was walking to work with coffee in hand. And it, as I say, it's the same in England these days. But it's just sort of trying to sort of just sit with nothing and just be at peace. And enjoy that. And Deborah Daly sort of mentions too, like, you know, add more ritual to your life. That can help you sort of understand yourselves as sort of ourselves as part of this beautiful whole. It can be a really lovely practice. And she says this, which I think is beautiful, which is, she calls it being an audience for God. So if you remember at the beginning, I said that Brahmacharya can also be translated like literally as Brahma, God, Charya, sitting with, walking with, resting in. So this kind of walking with God, and so she calls it being an audience for God. And we don't need to be the center of attention, and we don't need to be active all the time. She sort of says we wear our busyness like a badge, and Brahmacharya reminds us that we aren't embodied in this form to feel dead, but rather to feel alive. And this sort of aliveness of this vital energy that we talked about at the beginning, this ojas, is really what we want to sort of cultivate in our life, this deep thrill and excitement, this sort of electrical charge that probably allowed Peace Pilgrim to walk miles and miles and miles in the name of peace. Is really what we're trying to cultivate. And she quotes Howard Thurman, Deborah Daly quotes Howard Thurman, when he says, don't ask yourself what the world needs, ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go and do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And it's a quote that we may have all heard before, but I think it's really beautiful when contemplating Brahmacharya, is to think of this like aliveness, because it's really, you know, what sexual energy is it's going to create life. And we have this like within us, and we don't have to just use it to create an external life, but we can use it to create like a real electricity in our own life. And that life within, that aliveness will seep out of us in vitality, and others will benefit from that. So it's sort of, it's kind of an esoteric yama, because really it's not something you can kind of think about with your head and discuss like we have some of the others. It's more sort of going inside and trying to tap into that aliveness within ourselves, and then see where we're being deadened, and where we're not. So I'm just going to read what Shirley's written here. So realizing our brains are hardwired to be addicted to something, because the hypothalamus gets activated and releases pheromones, we can choose our addictions, such as joy. Well, what a lovely thing to be addicted to joy instead, which would take the shame away. Yeah, so it's really, and one of, you know, I mean, really, if we're going to get down to exactly what Brahmacharya is, it's what the Gita talks about again and again, and that is being one-pointed, like keeping your focus entirely on God. So always thinking about the sacred. And when you have sex, if you're having sex, you have sex for God. Have a consecration before you have sex. if you're not going to be engaging in tantric sex, it's too much for you and you don't feel like being celibate, then consecrate your act of sex. Like, take that moment to understand it's sacred. Look into the other person's eyes and understand it's sacred. The same when we sit down to eat food, like look at our food and understand that this is sacred. This is energy that's coming into us that keeps us going. So and when we have that sort of view of sacredness, when we see everything as sacred in the world, it helps us not to be greedy. You know, it's sort of, as I say, sort of being mindful. So I'm just going to finish with this comment by Sri Swami Sachidananda. This is in the Living Gita, and this is my favourite version of the Bhagavad Gita. So in chapter 6, verse 14, Krishna says, "Sit in yoga meditation, serene and fearless, firm in the vow of brahmacharya, and with the mind calm, think of me and only me." Swami Sachidananda says, if we could all do this, there would be no need to meditate. Just erase all fear from your heart, means don't even be afraid of God. Just be serene, think that you are the child of God, and think only of me. And here, Krishna means oneness. He's not saying think of Krishna. He's saying just think about like God or the spirit or oneness or Brahma. And so he goes on to say, brahmacharya literally means constantly thinking of the absolute, which is easy if you can control all the senses, which is why controlling the senses is also known as brahmacharya. But really, the true meaning of brahmacharya is to put your attention entirely on Brahman, the absolute one. Just idea of just walking with God, which is such a lovely translation if you want to translate it that way, brahmacharya, of just always thinking about God in everything that we do. So, you know, bringing those mental thoughts back in when they start to wander elsewhere, keeping ourselves in a position of balance and non-excess, and using all the energy we have in this precious lifetime to serve others and for self-realization. So that's it for today. I was going to play you a song, but I've run out of time. So I'll simply leave you now to, I think we've got Ajayashanti coming up again, Walking Exclusively with God, says Kathy. Yeah, it's a beautiful translation. So thank you. Next week, we're going to finish our yamas, our final one, the Parigraha, which is letting go, which is a really beautiful one ahead of the holidays as well. So thank you all. I wish you a beautiful week, one of non-excess, moderation, and aliveness. namaste.